Well, it's CIUT, the Taylor Report, and we're going to talk to the bluesologist, Norman Otis Richmond. And today is the day to be doing it. In August, we're still in August, and terrible things are happening. But we need to talk to Norman. How you doing, Norman?
I'm fine personally, but I mean the world situation is it's not bleak, but we're in a moment of history that is pretty. I don't know if I've ever witnessed anything like this with the pandemic and the police pandemic and things happening all in every corner of the world. It's a good and a great and dreadful time to be alive, you know.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. We've had, it's a, what you might call a typical American killing, police killing of an unarmed black man, this time 7 shots to the back. But the political reaction is of a different character. I guess what's most notable is that professional athletes, the National Basketball Association, and it led by, I think, the Milwaukee Bucks and the Toronto Raptors, decided in the midst of playoffs not to play. And I've never seen a time when professional teams owned by big white reactionary people were able to walk off like that and shut down a $1 billion sports industry. Tell me what you think about these players and who among them do you particularly notice?
Well, first of all, I think that, you know, Canada has its problems with, the authorities just dropped the charges against the police that killed Regis Perkinsky. How you pronounce her name correctly? Perkinsky Perkett, a young indigenous African woman who was killed in Toronto, allegedly. Well, let me say.
Yes.
The cops claim she fell off of the balcony, 23, 24 stories. I know a guy by the name of Desmond Cole went there actually saw her body laying out there. But she was, the parents claim that she was pushed and the police say she fell. And the police have the last word, of course. So they basically found that to be not guilty, so I didn't want to let that go by and not mention the fact that Canada is not so great when it comes to the police anymore, right? Either.
You know, it is, again, it's so we're having these episodes now at such a rate. I suppose the other thing to be mentioned is, of course, I saw an athlete, an NBA player, I can't tell you his name, but he said, look, now we have instant replay, and now we have handheld people using their mobile phones, and they take these pictures. And he says, you can't argue with instant replay, and you can't argue with these pictures. That, you know, you and I lived through a time when there would be a lot of black victims, and always the official report would be, oh, he was threatening the officer, he was fighting, and all kinds of stories, but it's getting harder for them to concoct their lies and, you know, all of them go back to the station house and make up a story because there's pictures all over the country of what they did.
Oh yeah, most definitely. But you had asked me a question about the athletes and how they're responding.
Yes.
Well, I think that the NBA is leading the pack, and I think that the hockey players, I don't know, hockey is a sport that I lived in Detroit for a while, so I know that there is some interest in hockey. I remember Marvin Gaye talked about actually playing hockey, working out with Gordie Howe, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, it's there for a lot of people. Didn't hear that one before.
Oh, yeah. I know, but the you know, the hockey players, I guess that's the whitest and the most reactionary sport in North America. I mean, they're like light years behind the NBA. You know, I guess the NBA being 78%, 80% black,
yes,
and Africans from black people from all over the world. And, you know, I guess you have a certain set of Eastern Europeans and other, and also white North Americans, mm-hmm. But they are definitely leading the pack when it comes to the whole question of social justice. You know, a lot of people are criticizing LeBron James. I guess they want LeBron James to be Huey P. Newton or Imam Jamil Alameen. But in terms of the context of what he's doing in terms of sports, I think he should be commended.
Yes. Kareem Jabbar has written, he by the way, has developed into a really an impressive columnist. I think he publishes the Washington Post, I'm not sure. But he said, you know, he felt it was his duty to point out, he says, in fact, when he took the action he took, he was shunned by other athletes, but particularly white athletes who didn't want anything to do with the subject. But he says now he is impressed that the National Football League play, and teams like New Orleans, you would not expect New Orleans Saints to be very good, but actually they've been able to convince the entire team to join in an effort. Same with the Detroit Lions. So he said that from his vantage point, he notices that difference. He felt terribly isolated, and it took a terrible toll on him. You know, when he didn't go to this, I guess it was the 68 Olympics.
Nope, he bowed out way before anybody else. He basically says he wasn't going to go. Period.
Those guys,
I think he might have taken his position even before Harry Edwards tried to organize the boycott. I think Kareem Abdul-Jabbar basically said he wasn't going anyway.
Yeah, it's really, in terms that they talk about, Edwards got in trouble, and of course, the two Olympic runners. And they suffered, their family suffered, they suffered financially. And so there is a, on the level of athletics, a kind of shift. He's hoping, and maybe he's too optimistic, that there is less tolerance of police violence broadly in society. By the way, Bill Russell is also speaking. Tell us about Bill Russell. He's from the Bay Area.
Oh yeah, Bill Russell was born in Monroe, Louisiana, and came to the Bay Area as I don't know how old he was, but he born in Monroe, Louisiana. And by the way, his brother was Charles Russell, who was a great playwright, and he did a film. They did one of his films called Five on the Black Hand Side, which a friend of mine, H.B. Barnum, did the music for. But anyway, Bill Russell is the original militant when it comes to taking a stand. He's always been outspoken, and I don't know how many rings he has. He has more rings than he has fingers. I think he has about 12 rings, doesn't he?
I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. You're talking about
Bill Russell.
Six or
because when you see Bill Russell, he has a picture. There's pictures of him. He's got like rings on every finger and maybe on the thumbs. I don't remember that. But
He's one of the great stories. People should study the life of Bill Russell. He's a lot like Jack Johnson. The world was burning down around him, and he performed at the very highest level of his sport, profession, right straight through until he had gray hair. And he was intimidated by, he played in Boston, which Boston has got to be one of the worst. He, as you know, at the height of his career, someone broke into his house and defecated in his bed.
Yes.
At a time when he was being voted the most valuable player. They wrote racist slogans on the walls of his house. And of course, when Muhammad Ali took the stand, Bill Russell was one of the first to come to his side.
Yep. No, he is an extraordinary a human being. And we should have mentioned the brother who ran from California, who won the 400 meters. He coached the Nigerian team for a while. I'm having a senior moment. He was out of California, and he coached the Nigerian team, and he's still in the land of the living, but very outspoken. He was in Saudi Arabia, all over the world. He was a coach. 200 meter man.
Yeah. Norman, you must be impressed that today there was a demonstration, a lot of demonstrations in the U.S. I was looking at one on CNN, and lo and behold, there was the son of Fred Hampton.
Fred Hampton Jr.
Yeah, standing alongside the Blake family.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, you know, Fred Hampton Jr. is very big on social media. And
I did not know that. I was impressed to see him.
Oh yeah, he's on social media almost every day. And I listen to him all of the time. And his father, well, Fred Hampton, I think the only other place where Fred Hampton Sr. spoke was in some parts in Canada. He came to Canada. I think it might have been Saskatchewan. That's the only other place he spoke outside of the United States.
Mm-hmm. To me, I want to ask you about Kenosha and what happened. I'm looking at it, and it reminds me of really the old movies where they were trying to tell us that in the deep South, we have reactionary sheriffs, and they are close to the Klan, and they're very, and the movies always showed them saying, we don't want any outside agitators, and we and the locals, we're gonna make sure that these communists don't come in here and rile up black people, that kind of stuff. And I look at the sheriff of Kenosha, and that's kind of in the deep North, and he's talking about outside agitators. And he says there's nothing wrong with a kid, a 17-year-old kid with a semi-automatic rifle in a black neighborhood pretending he's a policeman. Doesn't that look like the caricature of the South that you remember?
Oh, without a doubt. But I think that, and I don't want to give a 45 too much credit because I think all the American presidents have been obnoxious and racist and supporting the status quo, but I think that 45 has emboldened has allowed the redneck element that is giving them a pass. So I basically think that that sheriff is probably getting a lot of he's part of 45's base.
Uh-huh. We're speaking to Norman Otis Richmond. Norman, where do people find you on the web, by the way, on the internet, and so they keep track of you?
Oh, you can just Google my name, Norman Otis Richmond, and I'm on Diasporc. I have a show called Diasporc Music on Black Power 96. I come on every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I have a two-hour show. I have an hour of music and an hour of interviews. And One of our regular guests is Dr. Gerald Horn. He's on every, he's been on every Sunday with me since 1999.
Again, it's Norman Otis Richmond, the bluesologist. I was looking at Jammu Baraka, who was the vice presidential candidate for the Green Party in the last 2016 election. I wish he was the candidate, the presidential candidate this time, but I think he's staying out of it. He's not too happy with Reverend Sharpton. He raised a question today on Twitter saying, Sharpton wants to turn this into a vote for Joe Biden. And he says, we got to ask some questions about the way the Democrats behave in office. What do you think of that?
The only thing I can say, like Max Roach used to say, ditto.
Say it again, what?
Ditto. I agree with him completely.
Yeah.
No, Al Sharpton is a, the ambulance chaser. Yeah, he is, he's there to put the fires out and to keep everybody, make everybody vote Democratic. You know, he's a Joe Biden and a Kamala Harris-ite, you know. That's my take on Reverend Sharpton, and I think he. I heard him on CBC last night. I mean, he made the national and the international news, and it looks like it's his job to, you know, pay for the family. He has a huge budget, so he can bring the families in, and he can get airtime and tell everybody to stay safe and stay within the Democratic Party.
Yeah. In that it is a something to be. I'm really glad that the Jammu Baraka is speaking out. I'm glad that you, Norman Richmond, is speaking out on these things because, you know, now they're running Kamala Harris, and speaking of her as a, you know, a person of color, and she understands everything. But I remember that now that when she ran for district attorney in San Francisco, she ran against the most left-wing district attorney in the history of the city, and Hallinan, I would like to ask them, why would you run against the most progressive DA in the history of San Francisco, Hallinan? And then in the case of Obama, the first time he ran for office, he ran for Congress, he opposed Bobby Rush, who was a sitting black congressman and a former deputy to Fred Hampton. Who are these guys that come to knock off progressive leaders?
Well, Kamala Harris, first of all, I wanted to make it clear to the world that my problem with Kamala Harris has nothing to do with biology. It has everything to do with ideology. Uh-huh. You know, the fact that she is a woman of color, and you know, I've seen her talk about how she likes One Nation Under a Groove by the Parliament, Funkadelic, and she went to Howard University. So she is definitely a woman of color, but everything you just said about her politically, she supports U.S. imperialism to the hilt. So that's my problem with her.
Yes. Well, and you had the incarceration issues in California.
Of course.
Where she would not, I couldn't believe my eyes. She actually, they said if they released the number of prisoners that the Supreme Court of California told them to release, they wouldn't have firefighters because they were using them as firefighters. I mean, doesn't that sound like, you know, post-Reconstruction South, where they said, well, who's going to pick the cotton? We can't let these people out of jail. We need them to pick cotton.
That sounds like 1887 or so, around that period of history. Yeah, she really, was a guy named Tyrone Davis had a song, Let's Turn Back the Hands of Time. That's what Kamala Harris did on that question.
Yeah.
She definitely turned back the hands of time.
Speaking to Norman Otis Richmond, Norman, what do you make of I want to ask you this. I brought up Fred Hampton's name too many times. Tell us, who was Fred Hampton And how did he die?
Well, Fred Hampton was the deputy chairman of the Southern Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. And he was only 21 years old. He was getting ready to be put on the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party. Now, most of the Panthers were a little bit older than Fred, but Fred was born, I think, in 1948. And yeah. I think the Illinois Black Panther Party was the largest chapter in the United States. And Fred Hampton was talking about socialism leading to communism, and he was clear on, he put together the Rainbow Coalition did not come from Jesse Jackson. The Rainbow Coalition came from Fred Hampton Jr. Fred Hampton Jr. was able to unite Africans. He was able to unite the Latino Latinx community. He was also able to tame. He actually went and there was a redneck group. I can't forget the name of the group. They were a young hillbillies, and he basically turned them around. When I say he turned them around, he basically turned them into against the state when they were really at in the beginning they were under the illusion of you know, the whole white supremacy thing. But Fred was able to convert them to
he must have been a gifted man. I gotta tell you, that takes talent. Well, what were the circumstances of his death? We got about, I think, 3 minutes here, if you could tell us. How did they kill him? Was that part of the COINTELPRO?
Well, they killed him. They set up there was a Eugene O'Neill, I think the guy's name was Stew Pigeon. They sent him in and paid him, I don't know, $600, $300. And he put something in Fred Hampton's Kool-Aid, so Fred Hampton could not wake up. And they came, December the 11th, I guess, 1969, and murdered him in his bed while he was laying next to his wife, Akua Najeri, who's still in the living, still in the land of the living. And she was pregnant. I thought she was 8 or 9 months pregnant with her Fred Hampton Jr. at that particular time. And
man who's speaking today.
Yep. And they killed him. And shot him when they came in and shot him point blank and said, now he's good and dead now, you know. And for my, all of my, my brothers and sisters who are race nationalists, the one who pulled the trigger was an African American who actually killed Fred Hampton.
Yeah.
Who fired the fatal blow.
That's a kind of another story that it gets repeated, the state using people.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Well, it's terrible what has happened to Mr. Jacob Blake, and I'm really, and our hearts go out, and we hope everybody will stay in the street till we get some justice. Norman Otis Richmond, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.